pilot's current location puts the wreckage at about 3,000 feet.
Recovery efforts continue for the pilot killed in a plane crash on the Alaska Peninsula. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 2nd. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, 17 feet long and over 100 pounds, a python is on the loose in the Mat-Su Burrow.
He was doing some yard work and left the door open and couldn't find the snake anywhere.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Authorities have shifted into recovery operations for a pilot killed south of the Chignik on the Alaska Peninsula Monday. 54-year-old Gabe Chiati was the only occupant in a Grant Aviation Cessna caravan that crashed into a mountain on its way into Perryville. Sergeant Luis Nieves says Alaska State Troopers are taking the lead in coordinating the recovery effort.
The pilot's current location puts the wreckage at about 3,000 feet on a 50-degree downslope. So we're reaching out to some of our mountain rescue partners, and then we're going to coordinate getting flights out to the location. And it's going to take a little bit to get out there.
Neves says the mountain where the crash site is located is still snow-covered, which will likely make the recovery a little hazardous this late in the spring. The pilot's body is trapped inside the plane. The National Transportation Safety Board will take the lead in investigating the crash. Neves says it's too soon to speculate on what went wrong on Monday's flight.
I'm looking at the wreckage. I'm looking that it's a pretty significant impact into the side of a mountain where he's at, but as to cause, who knows at this point? Was it low visibility? Was it equipment failure? We don't know. NTSB has to determine that.
Chinetti was from Italy. He had flown with Grant since 2014. A bill to fund the federal government through September is on the move in Congress, and it includes a long-sought land trade in southeast Alaska. The swap would exchange Alaska Mental Health Trust land near Ketchikan, Petersburg, and other southeast cities for about 20,000 acres of the Tongass National Forest. It would allow the trust to gain logging revenues to pay for mental health programming from land that is less controversial. The trust's plans to log areas near Ketchikan and Petersburg were strongly opposed by many community members. A bill allowing the land trade is also moving through the state legislature. The federal spending bill is expected to pass the House this week. It covers the rest of the fiscal year. It does not include many of the domestic spending cuts President Trump proposed for fiscal year 2018. The bill would boost defense spending, including a 2.1% military pay increase. It also has $150 million for pre-acquisition work on a heavy icebreaker for the Coast Guard. Representatives of two regional Alaska Native tribal organizations offered support for an income or other progressive tax. Tenena Chiefs Conference General Counsel Natasha Singh says Alaska Natives would contribute to a tax.
We often hear that we want an income tax because we wouldn't pay for it. That's simply not the case. We want an income tax because that's what's best for Alaska. We are part of this state, and we contribute far more to the economy than we are credited for in discussions about fiscal policy.
Singh spoke to the House Finance Committee. The committee also heard from other nonprofit leaders who support the legislature passing bills that would balance the state's budget. Singh says her organization would support drawing money from the permanent fund if the solution is balanced and doesn't disproportionately impact some Alaskans over others. The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska support a progressive tax, but not necessarily an income tax. The House Finance Committee is focused on the long-term budget plans this week. One of the sticking points between the House and the Senate is a disagreement over changes to the state's oil and gas tax and credit structure. Ranking members of both the Senate and the House seem to agree that the state needs to break free of a system that will leave it owing nearly $700 million in cash payments to oil companies by the end of the year. But Senate Republicans have completely rewritten the House's version of a reform bill. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more on Juneau.
So far this session, lawmakers in the majority parties in both the House and the Senate seem to agree that the state's oil tax credit system needs to change. But what will change is unclear. A Democrat-led House bill that kicked off this year's fight over oil tax credits passed into the Senate last month, and the Republican-led Senate has crafted a version that looks a lot different.
I would say the Senate bill is unrecognizable from the House bill. It's that different.
That's Anchorage Democrat Garen Tarr. Her House Resources Committee led the charge to push an oil tax credit reform bill through this session. And when it passed, primarily along caucus lines in the House, it was designed to cut oil tax credits, a key part of her caucus's plan to balance the state's budget. The House's bill cut credits that went to legacy fields like Prudhoe Bay. It doesn't allow companies to dip below the state's 4% minimum tax, and it axed a credit that companies could trade to the state for millions in cash payments. Industry is calling it a significant tax increase, and that bill landed with a thud in the Republican-led Senate that has agreed that some reform needs to happen, but seems largely uninterested in substantively hiking taxes on the industry. And there, lawmakers have crafted a bill that narrows the focus. Kathy Giesel's Senate Resources Committee wrote the Senate bill.
In fact, you could argue that they're the same issues that the House also has consensus with the Senate on, and the governor. And that primary issue is the cashable credits simply have to be repealed. We can't afford them.
Under the cash credit program, the state owes companies about $700 million in unpaid credits now, and that could balloon up to $1 billion by next year. Giesel says the Senate version of the bill also hardens the state's minimum tax, but it allows companies producing new oil to take credits that would dip them below that minimum. The Senate version of the bill will have to go back to the House for a concurrence vote, and it will likely run into opposition there. Tarr says the Senate version of the bill is too generous.
This is not a version of the bill that will be supported by a majority in the House.
Both the Senate and House versions of the bill have drawn criticism from oil and gas producers and an industry trade association. They've repeatedly asked lawmakers not to raise taxes during a low oil price environment. They've warned of further layoffs and delays in developing projects. And in public testimony, some Alaskans have echoed those arguments. For some, like Alex Vaughn, the impact of low oil prices and budget cuts have already hit, and they've hit hard.
A year ago, I was working for Kalis Energy, and they shut down the rig, which subsequently meant that I lost the job.
Vaughn testified before the Senate Finance Committee last Saturday.
And likely within the next month, I'll be headed to Texas, which is horrible.
Vaughn says his sister has been laid off from work in the industry as well. And he was among the majority of people who told that Finance Committee they want to see a stable tax structure that would encourage growth in the oil and gas industry. And the bill has a long way to go. The Senate Finance Committee has hearings scheduled to take it up every day for the rest of the week. If its version of the bill passes through, it will go back to the House. If it doesn't pass there, the two bodies will have to form a committee to negotiate on it together. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Mat-Su Animal Control says a 100-pound python is on the loose in Meadow Lakes near Wasilla. Borough officials say the snake has been missing for 2 days and could be a threat to small children or pets. They say residents in the West Mallard Lane area should keep an eye on their yards and be aware of any warm hiding spots on their property. Animal Control Officer Darla Erskine says the yellow and white snake's owner lost track of it and is starting to go door to door to warn his neighbors. That's when Erskine got a disturbing call.
I'll take the dogs, cats, and rabbits and guinea pigs cases. But yeah, I was the one that got the call. So I'm facing my fears to 17-foot albino Burmese python had gotten loose out of the house. He was doing some yard work and left the door open and couldn't find the snake anywhere. This is an unusual animal. It can eat a 25-pound rabbit. It could lay in waiting. You know, we were concerned. We needed to get the word out because it's a public safety issue in our minds.
An advisory statement from the borough says that animal control officers expect cold temperatures to weaken the snake or compel it to seek a warm place. Mat-Su Animal Control says the snake is most likely dead because of the cold. But Erskine says the cold temperatures might also have caused the snake to go into hibernation.
Then he could come out of hibernation when we have a warm up to a 80 or 90 degree day. Yeah, so I would really like to find him one way or the other.
Anyone who sees the snake is asked to call 911 or the Mat-Su Animal Care Department at 761-7501. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, examining fish guts might tell scientists a lot about the interaction of melting glaciers and the oceans.
Sometimes I like to talk about stomach content analysis of fish, like forensics.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Northern Edge is the largest military training exercise in the state this year. It's more than a week of practice between the U.S. Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, and Army, and involves thousands of personnel and hundreds of aircraft. Military officials say the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex is one of a kind for the training they need to do. They also defended the exercise against criticism that it's harmful to marine mammals and fishing in the Gulf of Alaska. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove was at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson and has more.
Northern Edge 2017 is officially off the ground. One after the other, fighter jets like J-Bear's own F-22 Raptors took off into the sky around Anchorage today to go fight imaginary enemies in the skies over Alaska. Only, the enemies aren't exactly imaginary. Another team of U.S. fighter jets, F-16s with the Red Squad, were lurking out there somewhere after having launched from Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks. They'll be working along with their own support crews and even a team of cyber operatives trying to hack the good guys to help improve warfighting skills that may be needed in the real world.
We need to train like we fight.
That's Colonel Christopher Niemeyer, the commander of the 3rd Wing at J-Bear.
What's unique is the fact that Alaska offers us the opportunity to put this large number of aircraft together in both overland and overwater airspace. You know, you might see a lot of aircraft taking off or arriving here at J-Bear or up there at Eielson Air Force Base, but you're not going to really hear much or see much after that. We're operating in areas either overland or overwater where there aren't a lot of people, and so we look very closely at that. Not just the people, but also the marine mammals and the other people in that environment. And we're pretty confident that we're not really having a significant adverse impact, but we're very sensitive to that.
The Summers for Salmon Coalition disagrees with that. Numerous fishing communities in coastal Alaska passed resolutions asking that Northern Edge be rescheduled for a different time of year, maybe when it has less potential impact for salmon fishing and marine mammal migration. Last month, Senator Lisa Murkowski penned a letter to military commanders asking that the exercise be held in the fall when it comes back to Alaska in 2019. We asked Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach, the senior military officer in Alaska, about how he makes the case for this exercise when asked by people concerned about fishing or marine mammals.
I know that some people feel that there is impact, but when we go to the people that are smartest about the science of the activity, they all tell us, and we're very confident that they're correct, that we're not having an impact on those species. I'll tell you what I think they should be thinking about is they should be hearing the sound of freedom and proud of their service members that are training so that they're as proficient as they can be, so that if they ever are asked to do their mission, they're ready.
As for the impact at J-Bear and Eielson, it means the bases are playing host to thousands more personnel than usual. J-Bear Commander Colonel Dutch Dietrich says that to accommodate them, the hosts have filled nearly every lodging facility they have, and they're keeping the dining facilities open for longer hours.
So it's almost like a whole nother installation being laid down on top of this one. I'm jazzed every morning to drive to work and see all those tails sitting on the flight line, and then throughout the day getting to see them take off.
Northern Edge 2017 continues until May 12th. For Alaska Public Media, in Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough is contracting for a plan to address community impacts of the Air Force's deployment of F-35 fighter jets at Eielson Air Force Base. The Borough Assembly voted to approve funding for the study at a meeting Thursday, during which Special Assistant to the Mayor, Jeff Strepp, outlined key issues.
The regional housing gaps that might exist, the fiscal impact of 3,500 new people and $500 million in spending coming into our community, impact on education, transportation, planning and zoning, public utilities and infrastructure, public safety and emergency services, health and social services, quality of life, workforce development, and regional coordination.
The Assembly Ordinance awards a $358,000 contract to Arcadis Corporation to do the study, with more than $200,000 coming from a federal grant. The Air Force is beginning new construction at Eielson in anticipation of the arrival of their first F-35s in 2020. Southeast Alaska is home to hundreds of glaciers and a lucrative fishing industry. As those glaciers retreat, the fresh water they send into the ocean could begin to dry up. Scientists are trying to figure out how that will impact the marine environment. Reporter Elizabeth Jenkins from Alaska's Energy Desk visited a fisheries lab to find out more.
The Gut Lab at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Fisheries Department in Juneau has all the traces of its namesake. Fish parts preserved in jars of yellow ethanol, but none of the smell. Master student Doug Duncan lifts open a cooler to show me this morning's catch.
We've got our one lone fish in here, and as you can see, it's a small one.
And I would say it's probably about the size of like my pinky finger, maybe.
Yeah, real little.
It's a baby chum salmon, no bigger than an anchovy. Typically, the scientists are trying to catch predator fish to bring back to the lab. And juvenile salmon are sometimes along for the ride, too, in the bellies of those larger fish. This little guy didn't meet that fate, but Anne Beaudreau, an ecologist at UAF, says figuring out how hatchery salmon ended up becoming lunch is a little like playing detective.
Sometimes I like to talk about stomach content analysis of fish like forensics, you know, because you're just piecing together all of these clues to try and figure out what it was when it was eaten.
It's totally like CSI fish,
yeah.
It's not the only mystery Beaudreau's team is trying to solve with fish guts. This study builds on another one that looked at glacial estuaries. About 5 years ago, Beaudreau moved from Seattle to Juneau, and she was curious about what she saw.
I was really struck by the fact that you can be out on the water in the marine environment and be looking at a glacier that's really not that far away. Thinking about, you know, with glaciers melting and receding rapidly throughout Southeast Alaska, all of that water is going somewhere.
Eventually ending up in glacial estuaries. So Beaudreau set out to find what type of fish lived in those waters and what they were eating. Freshwater glacial runoff mellows out the salinity of the ocean water, which is good for some kinds of fish. Plus, it can wash down debris like leaves that the fish like to eat. Beaudreau says scientists compared what fish were eating in estuaries near glacial rivers to those in rain-fed creeks.
As, you know, glacial systems transition towards more rain-fed systems, then it kind of gives us a window into what the future might look like.
It also helps scientists establish a baseline, something to contrast the future with, which right now is crucially important. Most of the world's glaciers are losing ice because of climate change. Beaudreau says scientists know that it's happening. What they don't know is how that melt will affect the marine environment. But one thing the study does prove is the interconnection between land or glacier and sea. Still, Beaudreau says more research is needed to answer the big question. What does that mean for fish? And she says a lot is riding on the answer.
Not even the million-dollar question. That's the billion-dollar question. Yeah, and I think the kind of work that we're doing is a really important start.
The research is on pause while Beaudreau looks for new funding for the project. In the meantime, her team is working on the hatchery study.
All right, so this chum salmon is 45 millimeters and it weighs 0.76 grams.
And Beaudreau is also holding on to tissue samples in the hopes of someday continuing the one on glacial estuaries. But right now, it's not easy to find federal dollars for climate change research.
A lot of people are concerned about, you know, our ability to keep this work funded.
She says her team will keep investigating the stomachs of predator fish.
Every little study that we do is just, you know, one piece of a bigger puzzle.
A puzzle, she says, that will take a lot more scientific research to solve. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business.
Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Haynes Clinkett master carver Wayne Price is well known for his art in Alaska. He's carved close to 40 totems that stand throughout Southeast. But until recently, none of Price's totems stood in Haynes, where he lives. As KHNS's Abby Collins reports, art created for the local veterans' village changes that.
The Chilkat dancers of Klukwan and the Deshu dancers sing, dance, and drum as they make their way toward a towering structure. Two healing totem poles and a screen. They enter to a song Price calls Knocking at the Door. A big crowd turned out to watch Price reveal his latest piece of art. A mix of locals and veterans in town for the Alaska American Legion Convention gathered outside a veterans housing complex in Haynes.
I've been an artist and carver for 45 years, and I want to tell you the story of what this screen means.
The 12-foot-tall healing totems and 8-foot screen tower over Price. He said he worked with veterans in nearby Klukwan to come up with the design.
Artistic interpretation of warrior spirit screen with raven dog salmon and eagle wolf totem poles for the Sobolov McRae Veterans Village and Wellness Center.
The Haynes Assisted Living Board commissioned the piece for the Veterans Village and Wellness Center. The village is named after Walter Sobolov and Howard McRae. Price says their clans are represented in the art. Raven dog salmon is the clan of Sobolov, eagle wolf is the clan of McRae. Price walked through the meaning of the screen, starting right in the middle.
The warrior spirit is in the center, honors our men and women who have served the United States of America in the military, with eyes focused on all veterans, including U.S. prisoners of war, those missing in action, and those who have sacrificed their life for freedom.
He said that is where a healing spirit sits.
Radiating healing energies from its hands, heart, and mind to the human heart and minds of all veterans.
Price moved on to the second circle.
The second holding circle is raven and eagle. In the Tlingit tradition, they represent the balance of the people. They hold the eye of the ancestors watching over us. They are the communities that the veterans come from and sacrifice for.
And finally,
the outer circle is a traditional native sacred circle of red, yellow, black, and white. It represents the medicine wheel in the four directions.
Price turned over ownership of the work in a customary carver's dance. He danced to the Mandarin song, holding the traditional hatchet-like tool he used to carve the screen and totems.
I'm going to dance with this adze, and at the completion of this song, I release title, and from that moment on, it belongs to all of you. It's choice.
Ted Hart danced and sang throughout the ceremony.
All people, black, white, red, and yellow, all serve the same. Kunas chish. Ha'it ida shiye. Shtuga ha de ti. Ikach. Thank you for helping. We are grateful for you. I hope these poles and screen bring peace and harmony to our vets, just as they will bring balance to our community.
American Legion National Commander Charles Schmidt thanked Price and the Haynes community.
This is a beautiful sign and a reminder of what takes place on these grounds here, the wellness facility to honor veterans. Veterans that have served this country, and we will never forget their service and their sacrifice.
Price says there is a lot of emotion in moving on from a major piece of work like this one. But outside the Veterans Village, for the first time, his healing artwork is not too far from his home in Haynes. In Haynes, I'm Abby Collins.
In less than 2 weeks, Miss USA will be crowned, and one of the hopeful contestants is from Southeast Alaska. 27-year-old Alyssa London touched down in Las Vegas earlier this week to prepare for the beauty pageant. She was crowned Miss Alaska USA earlier this year and is the first Tlingit woman to hold that title. KCAW's Emily Russell caught up with London before the competition.
Alyssa London has become somewhat of a spokesperson for her culture. London is the first Tlingit woman to be crowned Miss Alaska USA, and on May 14th, in front of a television audience of millions, London will showcase those roots. Her evening gown for the Miss USA pageant is adorned with Tlingit designs.
When I walk out on stage, it'll be a Tlingit robe with a killer whale, so Duxalwady form line, on the parts that tent out, as the Tlingit robe does. So I'm really excited for that moment, and so there's been a lot of work that's gone into that.
The gown's designer is Joey Galan, and the Tlingit artist Preston Singletary, he's responsible for the killer whale art that adorns it. London hand-selected these two, and she says she's been working for months for that moment to show it off. That work, though, it's not quite over yet.
So over the next couple days, I will go through some rehearsals and training practices in order to make sure that I can effectively perform the gown in 20 seconds.
Showing off months of work in just a few short seconds, it's stressful, London says. What's been the most challenging part about preparing for this competition?
Time management. I've been on a time crunch this whole time, and yeah, it's been hard to rush everything.
London was crowned Miss Alaska USA back in February this year, and she says she's been working and traveling ever since.
In the last few months have been a journey of hosting the Reservation Economic Summit for National Congress of American Indian, Economic Development Council. I've gotten to go and meet with kids at the Alaska Native Medical Center. I've gotten to meet with our state senators in D.C.
She's been on the road a lot, but London says she's found a way to stay healthy. She's proud of her body, posting photos and videos of herself on social media, running on the treadmill or doing squats at the gym.
I'm just trying to debunk the belief that beauty has to be this extreme fake quest. And I'm not even going to have fake nails. And it's going to be me up there. And so I hope that they like that.
If she wins, London would make history. She'd be the first winner from Alaska and the first with Native American or Alaska Native heritage. At stake is more than a crown, though. She's got a message, too.
I'm focusing on empowering women to design the life of their dreams through entrepreneurship, through getting their education, because when you pursue your education, it opens doors for all of the goals that you have for yourself.
Alyssa London will take that message to the national stage at the Miss USA pageant Sunday, May 14th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
And finally, a correction. Last night, we told you about a designation President Obama created for the Bering Sea that President Trump canceled in an executive order last week. We misnamed the designation. It's called the Bering Sea Climate Resilience Area. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. With reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Andrew Kitchenman, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Abby Collins in Haines, Emily Russell in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Sean Dugan is our editor and producer, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.